Thank you for supporting WBEZ. You keep public media public. December gifts are among the most important because they set the tone for our reporting in 2026. Next year, we're doubling down on bringing you stories that arm you with the facts. This journalism relies on everyone contributing what they can. Join them today at wbez.org/donate.
This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work, Policy, and Practice at the University of Chicago, where research meets real-world impact. The master's program in social work blends classroom learning with extensive field education guided by faculty known for groundbreaking research. Applications are open at crownschool.uchicago.edu/social work. Inspire change. Shape the future.
I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. We made it to the end of this frigid week. Time to step away from the headlines and dig deeper on the weekly news recap. Here are some of the stories to discuss.
Even though it's a little less snow, the temperatures are in the teens and single digits, so really no melting with that snow. It's very slick.
We went from an abnormally warm December to an abnormally cold January.
Top staffers in the mayor's administration, including the mayor himself, were made aware of allegations of unsanitary and unsafe conditions at the shelter as early as late October.
This email alleges the shelter had insufficient bathrooms, exposed pipes with sewage, cockroach infestation, and insufficient meals and water.
Our panel this week is Ravi Baishwal, anchor of ABC7's 5 and 6 p.m. newscasts, Paris Schutz, WTTW correspondent and co-anchor of Chicago Tonight, and Stephanie Zimmerman, a consumer investigations reporter for the Chicago Sun-Times. I had to start by asking them about the top story on everyone's mind this past week, the cold. We can't escape it, so I asked them, how did you cope? Here's Ravi.
I think something has happened in Chicago that people have gotten soft because I guess of what had happened in November and December. We had such mild temperatures, but just
That's
add
it.
On the layers, make sure you've got a hat, make sure you've got gloves, make sure you've got warm boots. And may I say, as a born Canadian, wear wool socks. That will help you. Don't worry about the fashion
part.
You
tell him, Ravi.
That's good. I'm a Wisconsinite by childhood, and I was all over the big crock pot of chili, you know, made a double batch.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
That fed us for a couple of days into all that kind of warm, yummy food.
Yeah, that's such a good idea.
One of the tricks I learned from being in the field and covering stories out when it was 20 below zero is if you wear snow pants, if you cover your legs and your head, your body is okay. It doesn't feel that bad. So I wore snow pants to work pretty much every day this week. And when I was walking my dog and it was fine.
Oh, yeah. Well, that sounds cool. Well, we saw snow overnight, Ravi, and early this morning. What else is in store for Chicago this weekend? Put your weatherman cap on.
You know, it's so funny because we obviously in television news, we talk about weather a lot because it's very graphics mm-hmm. oriented. And I've learned a lot listening to my colleagues, Larry Mowry and Cheryl
Scott. No green screen here today.
No green screen here. But really what we have here is after an incredibly mild December, which was the fourth mildest December in 50 years, mm-hmm. we're now flipping the page here. And this is the reason is, as I understand it, is that, you know, we're supposed to be cold right now. You've got this jet stream, which brings cold air from Canada. It comes down and comes back up. Well, that jet stream, there are things called Arctic oscillations north of it that are basically unstable air masses that are dropping even more cold weather right down into the heartland,
yeah.
right across the Great Lakes. And we're in for this for a little while. It is going to be a little bit warmer over the next few days, but it is going to be cold on the weekend. And then it warms up.
Yeah, I think on Monday it starts to warm
exactly.
up.
Exactly.
I've been hearing El Nino this, El Nino that. What is that again?
El Nino is the baby, and it is a warming trend.
The cold baby.
it is the cold baby. It is the warming trend, certainly through air masses and through large bodies of water in the ocean. It's a natural phenomenon that comes, you know, there's a cycle to it, and we're caught in the midst of it, and it has been going on for quite a while, but it is a disruptive force that you can point to
yeah.
in terms of meteorology that is leading to, among other things, some of this incredibly overall warmer weather that we've enjoyed this winter. But like I said, I used to build a backyard rink every single year, especially
really?
When the kids were younger. Haven't done it for, what, 6 or 7 years now?
Because it's been milder.
And the kids grew up. But still, I mean, I see fewer of them around.
Yeah. Well, Paris, let's shift gears here because WTTW recently learned more about conditions at a migrant shelter in Pilsen. What's the same one where 5-year-old Jean Carlos Martinez Rivero died last month. What did you find out this time?
Well, what we learned was that the Brandon Johnson administration had been made aware in late October, only weeks after this shelter had opened, that there were serious problems at this, you know, abandoned warehouse turned shelter, including raw sewage that was exposed and people sleeping near them, cockroach infestation, as you heard, insufficient bathrooms for the swelling population they had started with, you know, around 1,000, and now they're at like 2,500, which is way overcrowded for that space. There were illnesses, reports of illnesses breaking out. Mm. And so we filed a Freedom of Information request to get those emails that sort of had warned. They had been sent by Alderwoman Nicole Lee to Brandon Johnson and Department of Family and Support Services Commissioner Brandi Kanazi, warning of all those things. We got our FOIA response sent back nearly completely redacted. They withheld all of that information from us. But we did. I had seen those emails from another source. I knew it was in them. We reported on them. The next day, the administration chose to reverse course, to not hide that information from the public anymore. They unredacted it, and it confirmed that they were made aware of all those conditions where all those illnesses have happened. Let's not forget, several children have gone to the hospital with upper respiratory problems from that shelter. We should state, we don't know the cause of death of Martinez Rivero.
Okay.
So we cannot say that it's connected to those conditions. We don't know that definitively, but we know that the Johnson administration was aware of how unsanitary and unsafe that place was very early on.
Yeah, I mean, and how are they responding to that claim, right? The continued allegations that you knew this and you've known this for some time.
Well, it's interesting. Alder people are upset. They're Alder, even the Byron Sigcho Lopez, who that's his ward, and you'd think he might have known what was going on. But he said the administration never shared that with him. Everyone was kept in the dark. That the administration knew these things and they didn't tell anybody is something that's upset a lot of Alder people. So what they said after we ran our story, by the way, they didn't comment for my initial story. After we ran it, 24 hours later, they sent a statement outlining the different things they did in response to those things. So they said they removed cots away from sewers. They have an exterminator go in there once a week. That doesn't give you a lot of comfort. So it's confirming there is that infestation. And now you're spraying all those fumes in there. And 2,500 people in this poorly ventilated space are breathing that in. They say that there are CDPH, public health officials there to contain illness outbreaks. Some older people I talked to said it's kind of thin gruel here. It's kind of weak sauce in terms of what they're saying their response was. It still doesn't sound like the conditions there are sanitary.
Goodness. Folks, if you have thoughts, I mean, on what Paris just mentioned here,
I think
with the shelters.
I think with Paris's reporting on it, it's been incredible.
Yeah.
And if you saw actually the redacted email, it's incredible. All that is there that they offered through their FOIA request is essentially the address of the person who was writing it and the sort of the glad-handing hello and the goodbye.
Yeah.
That's it. The rest of it, it might as well have been out of the CIA. And you know, it's interesting to hear some of the discussion around this topic, not just in terms of the migrants, but in how the Johnson administration is conducting itself. And I think, Paris, you can see that the conversation goes back again to this what is perceived to be a lack of transparency and a willingness to sort of hold cards very close to their chest, the administration is, for fear of what, looking bad? We all know that the migrant crisis is happening in real time. No one really planned for it, and no one's blaming the Johnson administration for it. But it speaks to sort of the way they responded to a crisis.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I agree. I mean, when you look at those emails, it's not like anything that anybody didn't know or suspect. I don't know why they're so afraid of that, because I think a lot of people actually, feel for the people involved in trying to address this emergency. They didn't ask for it. These are forces that are much larger than the city of Chicago.
Yeah.
I mean, we have a governor in Texas who's scoring political points by sending these folks up here. And in the larger context, we have, you know, whole countries in Latin America that are not functioning.
Yeah.
And I think most people don't like just leave their country if they're happy. So there's all these larger forces at work. And I think I don't know why they were so weird about not releasing that information.
Well, Paris,
and she believes. Sorry. So I was saying we believe, you know, when they sent that back, I've never received documents back from a city FOIA redacted like that. And we believe they were in violation of state law when they redacted all of those things. So we had retained a lawyer and we were prepared to go to court to sue, to basically unredact. And we believe we would have won. And the next day they did unredact everything. So it does, as you said, Ravi, raises serious questions about transparency with this administration, and not just with the media. They have not been very transparent with the media, but other people who aren't in their inner circle are complaining that they are not sharing information, or they're not being listened to with their concerns.
Yeah.
That this has been a very insular administration. It seems like each successive mayor becomes more and more insular. They promise more and more transparency.
Yeah.
Started with Emanuel.
That was one of the great criticisms of the Lightfoot administration.
Yeah.
What this administration said, they weren't going to make the same mistake. And I guess it's easy to sit over here and criticize in this way, but it seems like in trying to control a narrative about good news or your agenda and not just reacting to headlines, they make the same mistakes, which is maybe the nature of power at City Hall.
Well,
I just want to agree with Stephanie. This administration has been dealt a horrible hand with this migrant crisis. And yes, you have to throw the blame at Texas Governor Greg Abbott for scoring political points to continually send folks here. The city clearly has scrambled. No one has bad intentions here.
Yeah.
They've scrambled to try and accommodate this and clearly have not been equipped to do so thus far.
Well, part of this scramble, we know tens of thousands of migrants have been bused here to the city from Texas, as Stephanie mentioned. No new buses have been dropping off migrants over the past few days. I'm assuming that's because of the weather. But this transportation company that was bringing migrants here is now suing the city. Why, Paris?
Well, they're saying that these new restrictions that the city put in place in terms of where a bus can drop migrants off, it's a very localized region, and when, because they're just trying to get control so buses don't just go any old place at any old time. They're saying that violates interstate commerce, that violates the rights of migrants. They're saying the migrants want to come to Chicago, so to say that they can't be dropped off is violating their rights. I really don't know where the law falls on that. But again, I know that
they're also claiming it's discriminatory because of who's on those buses.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Because it's migrants on the buses. So you're discriminating where they can be dropped off and when. But it's in response to this ordinance that basically is trying to get control over where and when the buses, come.
This landing zone, right?
This landing zone, right.
Yeah. The city wants migrants dropped off at this landing zone. But so where are they being dropped off currently?
They could be dropped off anywhere.
Anywhere.
And certainly after Chicago made its ordinance to try to rationalize where these drop-offs could happen with the landing zone, all the collar communities and the collar counties all had to pass resolutions they thought to protect themselves from essentially having to take on the migrant crisis in a place where they thought they just didn't have the resources to do it.
Yeah,
right. Yeah, there were buses going to suburbs, basically, Naperville, and basically those suburbs were taking the migrants, putting them on the Metro train and sending them to Chicago, basically.
Yeah, Mayor Johnson planned a Tuesday meeting to talk strategy to support migrants that are currently here. That meeting was postponed because of the weather. But Paris, to what extent would you say the city and the surrounding suburbs are coordinating efforts here?
I don't think there's really any extent. I think this was the first maybe attempt at trying to find some kind of coordination. I do think the state has kind of come in and taken over some of it. I mean, they're running that shelter in Little Village. Some city council members want the state to do more. I do think the governor and the state feel like the city has been in over its head in trying to manage this with the Garda World tent fiasco. So now the state is trying to manage some of this. Oak Park, is doing its part, but I think this was the first stab at some kind of coordination because we've seen suburbs that just don't want them at all. And so, again, this is where you have to cut the city of Chicago some slack. They've taken on everything, and suburbs haven't done their part, and collar communities haven't done their part, and there hasn't been coordination.
Yeah. So the governor's pledging some more support to our city in support of this crisis?
I think it was something like $17 million something like that. Yeah, in terms of, and I think this is coming just out of a budget that's already sort of, I don't think it's new money. But it's certainly not going to be enough. I mean, there's the city's pledged $150 million. It's going to cost two, three times We don't know how much it's going to be. It just depends on how the
it also speaks, though, Paris, and I'm sure you think the same, that how big an issue this really is and how much of a federal issue this is and how much pressure there is on the White House to do something about this. And if, essentially, the kind of effectiveness, hate the tactics, but the effectiveness that Governor Abbott is having down in Texas to get this on the national agenda. And there's no question, I was reading again about how much more, even in a sanctuary city in a Democratic state like Illinois, this immigration issue is starting to become problematic for the Democrats.
Right. And I just keep coming back to this. You know, these are human beings that we're talking about. And you know, Donald Trump himself, he'll probably be the Republican nominee for president. He doesn't really want a deal on the border because this issue helps him. You know, people are scoring political points off of this. And, you know, and the other thing is I look at it in the larger sense, you know, coming back to just these countries that have these big problems. I was thinking as we were, you know, preparing for this segment, in the larger sense, what about global warming? I mean, get ready for the migrant issue to go crazy when people can't live in certain parts of the world because they become inhabitable. So this issue is really not going to go away. There are going to be people who want to move to other countries, move north, and we have to come up with some kind of solution.
I think you hit the nail on the head there. It's not just Donald Trump. I really think that most Republicans, they go and they have their press conferences at the border. They go and, you know, scream and cry about the folks. I don't think they want a deal either because why hasn't there been a deal in 20 years? This is the best issue ever.
It's a great issue for an election campaign in 2024.
It gets them elected.
I think it gets
ratings on a certain cable news channel. I mean, it's the issue that keeps on giving. So if they're so concerned about it, why haven't they cut a deal in 20 years?
It'll be very interesting to see how the negotiations go with the new speaker, Mike Johnson, in Washington over this, because they're tying immigration reform and shoring up the border with aid to Israel and aid to Ukraine. And it's interesting. I think I heard Representative Raja Krishnamurthy on one of those channels. And he was talking about how his colleagues in the House on the Republican side won't actually take yes for an answer as it comes to immigration reform. We'd have to parse out all of that.
We got an update on conditions for migrants staying at city-run shelters and how the Johnson administration is handling the crisis. Plus, we talked about the freezing temperatures. Let's turn now to something else that affects lots of people. That's the cost of renting. Here's Stephanie talking about different fees renters end up having to pay.
Yeah, these are what consumer advocates call junk fees in apartment rentals. And here you are shopping for an apartment, you're looking at what the rent is going to be, and lo and behold, there's all these other fees. And they can add, in some cases, a couple hundred dollars extra to your monthly budget. It makes it really hard to comparison shop. It makes it really hard to plan your life.
Wow.
And for some people, it can contribute to...
And do you know this right off the bat, or is this more so like once you sort of sealed the deal, you're signing things, and then they're like, oh, by the way.
Yeah, both of those. I mean, sometimes when you're looking, you'll find out. Like, they'll tell you there's also an application fee and this and that, and
a move-in fee.
Some folks have heard about it as they're signing, or even later there were fees buried in the lease. But these can really add up. Application fees we've seen as high, over $200 for application fee.
Yeah, give us some dollars
check.
Here, like the difference for some folks that you talk to.
Yeah, one of the Bucktown apartments was $237 just for the application fee and credit check. Then a non-refundable move-in fee, $700. You know, that used to be a security deposit back in the old days, and there's some landlords that still use security deposits.
Will they do a move-in fee and a security deposit?
No. They just do a move-in fee, but they keep it. I mean, the security deposit, you had some hope of getting that back, right? Mm. And then they have these bundle fees of like $50 a month, and that will do things like, you know, things you thought were included anyway, like trash pickup, the use of an online portal to pay your rent.
Ask for maintenance.
that's my favorite, the maintenance hotline, which is like the cell phone number of the guy that's going to come fix your sink or whatever.
It's just
crazy things like this. And then when you move out, you could get hit with a whole host of other fees. $15 for a light bulb, $150 an hour to clean the kitchen if they don't think it's sufficiently cleaned. So these are
just
sort of piling on of these fees. And there's some folks who've said they've had enough. And there's a few states that have taken action on these fees.
Oh, my goodness. You talked to renters, but you also talked to landlords.
I did.
What are they saying?
you know, I asked them and they said, well, the reason why they hate security deposits so much is that they're complicated. They have to keep them in a separate account. They have to return it with interest. So they don't like that. But they also don't like that many renters will just say, well, I'm not going to pay my last month's rent when I'm going to move out because the landlord can just keep the security deposit. Mm-hmm. But if they wreck the apartment, then the landlord doesn't have anything to pay to fix it all. And one landlord told me he pays about $2,000 just to turn over a unit. So I do understand that. Mm. However, some of these fees really seem disconnected from reality, like a maintenance hotline.
And some of the numbers that you were quoting in your article were incredible. It was actually raising the cost in one case 50% when you added it all up. It was $2,000 for the apartment, but it was close to $3,000 when you added in all those fees, which reminds me, you know, it's cold. We're all thinking about going to Florida or Mexico or something, and then you get a resort fee. Well, I thought that that was what I was buying in my vacation, which reminds me of this episode of The Simpsons when a movie is being produced in Springfield and the mayor comes in and he just starts throwing all these crazy fees at all the producers and they're just it's just absurd. And this is starting to feel this way and it's making its way right up to the White House. They're worried about these
and
kinds
of things. It makes me feel that way when I want to get out of my snowbound house and go see a concert and I buy my ticket and at the end there's a giant concert ticket fee. This is all part of this junk fees thing. And the White House is trying to make this an issue, actually, you know, for the election, telling people that they're trying to get rid of these junk fees in a whole host of industries.
And there has been some development in this. Think about with airline fees. It used to be kind of opaque like this as well. And then it came from on high that you had to say, this is the price.
Yeah.
Taxes.
These are the taxes.
And that makes it so much easier, as you said earlier, to comparison shop.
Right.
And well, consumers need to be.
Let's shift to another story that Stephanie's been working on. And Paris, I'm sure you can weigh in on this one. I mean, you looked at car insurance rates, Stephanie, for Illinois drivers. Paris
everybody's
sighing
groaning.
There. I haven't even told you what the story is yet, Paris.
Two teenagers.
Keeps me up at night.
It keeps you up at night. Have you felt the pinch of high car insurance prices?
I mean, it went from a couple years ago being like under $100 to $337 right now. And I live on the northwest side of the city. I mean, mine is related to the rash of car thefts and the insurance keep going up.
Well, Stephanie, what did you find?
Yeah, so this was a story about an analysis that was done by Illinois Purgate Education Fund. It's a consumer group, and they do this regularly. They analyze the rates that are charged to Illinois drivers. So they looked at the 10 biggest car insurance companies and their subsidiaries, and that makes up about 81% of all Illinois drivers. In 2023, these companies raised their rates on us by $1.25 billion, and that's on top of 2022, when it was $1.1 billion increase on Illinois drivers. State Farm and Allstate are two of the biggest, and they have raised rates by many hundreds of millions of dollars. And it's really painful, I think, for consumers because this is not a product that you can decide you're not going to buy. It's mandatory to have, you know, to be able to drive. So it really is pinching a lot of people. The industry says that even though inflation is now, you know, trending down, prices are still really high for things like repairing vehicles after a bad accident or paying for medical bills for people after a bad accident.
Yeah.
So they say that they need to do that. Now, there is legislation in Springfield, and there's going to be a big fight over that because the car insurance companies do not want it. But that's Representative Gazzardi's and Representative Cervantes, both of Chicago. That would give our Illinois Department of Insurance the authority to either reject or modify what they consider excessive rate increases.
Oh,
and there are some states that have this ability. Illinois is one of the most lightly regulated states as far as insurance because we have so many big insurance companies headquartered here, Allstate and State Farm being the two big ones. But this bill also would eliminate non-driving factors in setting of rates. So it would take things out of the equation that are used here, like gender, marital status, age, occupation, home ownership, schooling, credit scores. It would take that out of the equation and when they set these rates, and that's also very controversial. Mm-hmm. The consumer groups say that those factors disadvantage mm-hmm. huge segments of the population who may be wonderful drivers. You know, you could have somebody with a bad credit score who's a really good driver. You could have a person in a really wealthy neighborhood who has a DUI, and that person, that guy might be paying less.
Yeah.
So they say it's not fair. And Sasha, you and I have talked about this in the past. The car insurance companies, though, say that it, anytime you take away the factors, it makes the risk assessments less mm-hmm. predictive. So it's a huge issue, and we're going to see a lot of that in the coming year.
Paris, the Cook County Inspector General says that some county workers, they've defrauded the Paycheck Protection Program. Remind our listeners what that program is.
Well, the Paycheck Protection Program was the COVID-era program that if you... you know, if you had to shut your business down because of COVID, if you had to, you know, close it down, that you were able to get a loan that you wouldn't have to pay back, basically, if you proved that, you know, you lost business because of it. And this is just another, I mean, this has seemed to happen all over city agencies where some folks that apparently had full-time jobs, public jobs, were, I guess, running other businesses and mm-hmm. then fraudulently claimed that they were owed this PPP money, and the inspector general has been pretty aggressive at going after some of these folks in multiple city agencies and prosecuting them.
How much did he say the workers stole from the program?
Gosh, it slips my mind
the
right now.
The county one, it was $1.2 million.
Mm-hmm.
But there's been other, I mean, it's not just these county workers. It's all sorts of folks working in government.
Mm-hmm.
And Paris mentioned the people that were doing the side hustle businesses that, you know, may or may not have qualified, and to say nothing of the possibly fake businesses that were created right. to get money from these programs.
And we were all warned about this, that in the rush to bring out aid during COVID, people forget about how sort of worried people were and how quickly things had to be rolled out and how there were going to be administrative snafus, there were going to be huge gaps. So we kind of knew some of this would happen,
yeah.
but it still shocks you when you see public servants, you know, doing something on the side, something like that,
yeah.
when they know clearly that this is probably not kosher.
I don't know. I'm not sure.
I don't think we know the extent nationally of how this program was defrauded. I mean, it's got to be, you know,
in the
hundreds of billions.
Yeah, in the billions, for sure.
I don't know that there's been one, like, you know, Justice Department investigation that, like, looked into, like, how much, because it just was put together so quickly.
Yeah.
And it just seems like it was so easy to just, like, fraudulently claim this money.
Yeah, to Ravi's point, I mean, I think the most disgusting thing is when it's public servants, because, you know, yes, of course, fraud happens, but then you find there was a top official at CPS involved in that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So,
well, you know, on this same topic, Ravi, Chicago's Inspector General Deborah Witzberg released her latest quarterly report, and she noted a clerk office worker who was pocketing cash payments.
It's
how much was the
story.
Worker caught with?
Apparently, over 7 years, probably cashiered about $200,000. Now, what happened here was this: an employee of the city clerk's office pocketed this in terms of imagine this, for the city stickers program. They have a very technologically unsavvy system there, a lot of paper records. So over the years, this clerk, who shall not be named, was basically taking in cash from people who were buying their city stickers and then marking and handing back the sticker, marking that as having been paid for. And then the cash was never put in the till. There was actual basic comptroller functions missing. And this has been going on like for 7-8 years. And what's also very upsetting about this is that when the person was essentially found out, this was before COVID, and the inspector general's office was actually starting their investigation 4 or 5 years ago. And only now are we hearing the extent of what had happened.
Mm.
And apparently the clerk in question has been put on the do not hire list.
Oh, which means
we would hope.
Yeah, there are no criminal charges yet.
And that list
there
is growing,
but
by the way.
The absurdity, don't make sure they're not on the do not hire list. And there's another one that the inspector general found
really?
As well. sort of related with your water bills and other city bills and so on. Debt collectors come in and they make a contract with the city and they say, okay, you know what? We're going to go, you pay us whatever, 75 cents on the dollar, and we're going to go out and get all these delinquent accounts paid up for you. But the city has to pay that debt collector up front. Well, there was one debt collector who had a contract, and they were able to, in an unauthorized way, be able to take a look at a bunch of city records for people who actually had paid their bills.
Oh my gosh.
They weren't even delinquent.
Insane.
And so
they might have gotten it off of my bill.
Right. Paris, we can't see you, but sure. Are you shaking your head too?
No, because how long have we been around?
I know.
But it's amazing. So then they say, okay, let's just pick a number. We're gonna send out bills for $100 million worth of delinquent accounts, and they might get some of that paid back because people think, oh, gee, you know, I don't want to pay the city. I'd be on the wrong side of the city. And then they get their money up front. And so this was a 25% payback, a kickback to these debt collectors.
Unbelievable.
So certainly the recommendation from the Inspector General's office is that, you know, you really kind of need to use some technology here. You need to be able to modernize your systems. And the clerk, Anna Valencia, has acknowledged all of this and says that's why basically she was elected, and that's what she's promising to do.
Yeah, and with that, the clerk worker that was pocketing those cash payments, the report says, you know, during the course of the investigation, the employee resigned and did not give a statement in OIG's
and was placed on the do not rehire
list. And also was placed on the do not rehire
list. I just think it's so insane that there couldn't be another person sitting next to them as they're handling cash.
Well, here's the thing.
I mean, I count the donations at my church on Sundays.
Well, there
has to be two people to make sure Stephanie doesn't steal the money. I mean, how is that so basic?
Yeah. No, someone noticed it and flagged it.
Right. And they were always small amounts, too.
Right.
That's the other thing. Just little bits here and there.
We're in the home stretch of our weekly news recap, giving you a closer look at the top stories across Chicago and Illinois. After 3 months of trial, a federal jury convicted 6 gang members in the killing of Chicago rapper FBG Duck. Here's Paris with the details.
Well, back in 2020, FBG Duck was killed by these purported gang members outside of on Oak Street. His real name's Carlton Weekly. He's a drill rapper. And it's sort of part of what apparently prosecutors said was an ongoing gang feud. And it kind of is a glimpse into this kind of dark world of drill rap where, you know, there's rap that's put out on social media. There's videos and songs, and it's put up on YouTube, and it's put up on TikTok and all that. And they're talking about, you know, gang feuds and killing each other in these raps. And a lot of it is entertainment, and a lot of it, you know, they're making money, and it's you know, they're getting downloads, you know, mm-hmm. but then it crosses the line into real life where there are real gang feuds. And apparently this was one this murder was, again, according to this case, a part of a gang feud that this rapper was involved in. But again, this you've heard this so much with drill rap, is that like you don't know where the line between, you know, entertainment here and real life sort of murder and mayhem
I mean, as you said, you know, prosecutors, they're tying this shooting to like gang wars and diss tracks, and so it has a lot of other rappers and other music artists in the industry paying close attention to this,
and they're getting their attention, and who knows what kind of antecedents those are for the kind of violence that we see on the streets in Chicago. Invariably, so many of these drive-bys and so many of these unexplainable phenomena, not just on the south and west sides, but primarily there, are just the reasons why these things happen just kind of disappear into the ether, mm-hmm. and there's no denying the cultural link to what's going on there.
Yeah, you know, there's an interesting book called The Ballad of the Bullet. I don't know if you guys have read that, by Forrest Stewart. It's a fascinating look at drill rap, and it's interesting because the consumers of this music are oftentimes white suburban boys who like to listen to this, you know, rough music. Yeah. And like Paris said, it has real world consequences. Mm-hmm.
Paris, sentencing is not until August for the folks who are convicted in this case. Any idea what we can expect here? Or are we looking
at life? life sentence, of course. Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't see, I mean, would anyone see any reason why this wouldn't be life sentence for everybody involved?
Yeah, I would expect so.
Yeah. Let's turn, Stephanie, to another story here. Illinois is soon going to have permanent rules about how gun owners of assault rifles and other weapons can register them with police. What do we know?
Yeah, that's part of the new Protect Illinois Communities Act that bans the sale, manufacture, purchase, and possession of assault weapons. That includes both the weapons and large capacity magazines, different kinds of attachments, different kinds of ammunition. And people who owned these products were allowed to keep them, but they were supposed to register by January 1st. Only about 30,000 people made that deadline, covering about 69,000 guns. And that is for sure not all the guns. There are a lot of people that don't want to register. They, first of all, are challenging this law, and they're hoping to get it before the Supreme Court. And
I mean, there wasn't much of a consequence if they didn't.
Yeah, and they say the rules of information for the registration was vague and unclear. They also have concerns about who's going to have their information if they succeed in getting the law overturned. Nationwide, I did a story back in 2022 with my Sun-Times and WBZ colleagues looking at some of these weapons, especially with the use of switches, which is a whole other nasty issue. But in the U.S., I think there's like 20 million AR-15s. And I looked specifically with that story at large capacity magazines. And I remember there were like 80 million in circulation of 30 rounds or more, not to say nothing of the smaller magazines. So there's a lot out there. And if only 30,000 people have registered in Illinois, it's for sure a vast
undertaking. Nearly the whole thing. Let's turn, Revy, to another story that's on our radar. The Art Institute, it's fighting to keep a piece of art that New York authorities is saying, that doesn't belong to you. What's the back and forth there?
These are beautiful watercolor drawings by an artist named Egon Schiele. I think that's how you pronounce it, Schiele. And they were owned back in the day by a Jewish art collector and cabaret singer and an artist named Franz Friedrich Grunbaum. Now, the Nazis basically took all of his art when they sent him off to Dachau, which is where he died in 1941. So over the years, what happened to all that art that he had? Well, it has been the subject of a lot of sales, a lot of legal efforts to try to get this back to the heirs of Mr. Grunbaum. And now what we have is at the Art Institute is this gorgeous, and I invite you to go to your website, our website, this a Russian war prisoner is the picture. Mm-hmm. And it's a gorgeous watercolor, very, very striking of a Russian soldier. And that is at the Art Institute of Chicago. And the Art Institute of Chicago says, well, wait a second, we bought this correctly back in 1966. It's actually not on display right now, but it's traveled around and they've used it. But the DA's office in New York is saying that's part of a whole bunch of art.
Yeah,
that
this is not just
guy.
A one-off. Right. There are many that the Manhattan DA's office
right.
is
and there are three in particular. This is one. There are two others in this collection that, in fact, the holders, the owners now, have actually given back to the heirs of the family. And those are museums in Pittsburgh and at Oberlin College in Ohio. So they've surrendered those. Now, the Manhattan DA, Alvin Bragg, he is saying, I'm asking you to hold on to it. I'm not saying I'm going to go and seize it just now. And the Art Institute is saying we've done our provenance correctly. We can show where we got it legally, and we are using legal efforts to hold on to it. It's not that they're refusing to surrender it, but we will see. There have been a number, these kinds of things happen in the art world all the time. But the fact of the matter is that there is this idea of, well, who owned it and when did they own it? And was it legitimate for them to have even bought it back then?
These are beautiful pieces. You are right about that. Yeah. All right, let's shift to some sports because that's my expertise. Kidding. The White Sox.
That's fine.
Well, the White Sox, they're in serious talks to get a new stadium in the South Loop. How solid is that?
Can I just say I'm one of the, I didn't become a sportscaster because I love sports too much.
And you said you didn't become
And I didn't want it to be kind of ruined for me by just having to do it day in and day out. So this is one where, area where you're,
but
I
listening
guess you're
to
have
listening to you earlier, you could be a meteorologist too.
Oh,
yeah, right. He missed his calling.
Well, you know, news anchors are understanding is this thin, but it's pretty wide at any rate.
Paris, did you see this White Sox story?
I did. And, you know, I did a story last summer about potential city sites for the Bears if they did choose to stay in Chicago and build a new stadium. I thought the 78 would be a perfect site. It's ideal. And so the story here in the Sun-Times broke it, basically, that the White Sox are apparently in serious talks with the owner of that parcel of land, Related Midwest. And that parcel of land is Clark Street, Roosevelt. It's, you know, just south of the South Loop there. You couldn't get a better piece of land for a stadium. You've got two metro lines right on that land. You've got three CTA lines within a couple of blocks. You've got the Dan Ryan Expressway a block away. Mm-hmm. You've got Lakeshore Drive. And then you've got probably the best view of the skyline. You're right there in the city.
You've got train lines. You've got train lines.
Right.
16 square
blocks.
You've
got the river. You could take a riverboat to the stadium. I thought it would be an ideal place for a Bears stadium. Bears aren't going to look at that. They might look at the south of Soldier Field if they stay in Chicago. But it is an ideal spot for a new stadium. The question is, Jerry Reinsdorf has had all of his stadiums and all of his stadium enhancements built, not spending a single dime out of his own pocket, all spending the taxpayers' dime. Will there be talks of taxpayers trying to help out this one, especially when you're talking about the debate over whether the Bears are going to get handouts?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, though, that Mayor Johnson would basically publicly acknowledge that these conversations are going on. The quote is that he and Reinsdorf met to discuss the historic partnership between the team in Chicago and the team's ideas for remaining competitive in Chicago in perpetuity, which brings into the idea, as you bring in the history here, Paris, and people remember back in the early 90s, 1992, they nearly became the St. Petersburg Sox.
Yeah,
right?
I remember that.
Yeah.
They got a stadium built for them, and that is going to become a huge issue of public-private partnerships. And should these private businesses that make, frankly, lots of money, should they be taking taxpayer dollars even to mitigate risk and so on? It will be a massive debate in the city.
Yeah.
Given that they've already had this.
I feel like it was only yesterday that they got the deal for the current stadium to tear down Comiskey. I mean, that was 1991.
Right.
Time flies, I guess.
And they were rent-free for a while, certainly in the first few years. Now they're paying, what, $1.5 million a year in rent, which sounds like a lot of money, but when you think about Major League Baseball, what it takes to keep the Sox there, it takes putting a winning team on the field. That's what it takes.
Yeah, and they're nowhere near having that. But, you know, it's like it's almost like drip, drip, drip. That you get the story of, oh, they might move to Nashville, just like 30 years ago. Oh, they're going to move to St. Petersburg. So they're holding that up against the city. And now they're talking about a new stadium and a new location. Of course, it's leverage for Reinsdorf to get, you know, public money. This whole Illinois Sports Facility Authority, which is this quasi-governmental agency that runs Soldier Field and runs U.S. whatever it's called.
Guaranteed rate field.
It was created it was created by the Illinois General Assembly just for this deal, to get Reinsdorf his stadium and to not have to have him pay for it. Well, that's why
I wonder how Reinsdorf feels about that. He's 87 now. Both his teams are not doing so well. Is this the moment that he becomes much more of a, I don't know, guy who thinks more about the public purse? I don't know.
I don't think he's happy, I'll say that. Well, I can't let you all go without talking about the biggest viral sensation in these Chicago streets, a.k.a. Roscoe Village, the rat hole.
The rat hole.
What, Stephanie? What's going on?
The rat hole. You know, the rat hole is nothing new. It's been there for like 20 years. It's actually not too far from where I live. It's a cartoonish.
Oh, that's why we put you on this one.
Cartoonish imprint in the sidewalk. It's like a Looney Tune thing, like if a rat fell and fell into the sidewalk. Actually, the neighbors on that block feel that it's not a rat. It was probably a squirrel.
Yeah, there's no clear consensus here.
Yeah,
that's not as good a story.
I know. The squirrel hole, it doesn't sound good. Hopefully that squirrel lived, because I'm an animal lover. I would hate to think that it like just decayed and died there. But hopefully it got up, walked away. I don't know. But people have been making a pilgrimage to the Rat Hole ever since an artist, Winslow Dumain from Chicago, posted this on Twitter.
Yeah.
Got 5 million views. And all these people are coming and leaving coins and flowers and cigarettes and all kinds of weird stuff. Cheese at the
oh, my God.
Which then just attracts more rats.
Oh, my God.
Which, can I just say, on our website at ABC7, this one was very popular.
Same
this
here.
Was sitting
Same
really
here.
High.
But
well, I'm almost out of time. I want to know, Paris, rat hole or squirrel hole? What do you say?
You know, it's funny. I walk down Roscoe all the time, and I don't think I've ever seen
Okay.
this.
Well, me neither. So that makes two of us. Rat hole, squirrel hole.
Oh, it's got to be the rat hole.
It's a rat hole.
Yeah.
Stephanie. Squirrel. I vote squirrel. I vote squirrel.
Well, yeah. we'll have to leave it there.
It's an animal, too. We didn't want it to get squished.
Ravi Bashwal, anchor at ABC 7 News. Stephanie Zimmerman, consumer investigations reporter for the Chicago Sun-Times. And Paris Schutz, reporter and anchor with WTTW. Stay warm this weekend, folks.
Thanks, you
it's
too.
It's going to be great. You too.
Fuck y'all.
This episode of the Reset Podcast was produced by Brenda Ruiz, and it was edited by Meha Ahmed and Linnea Dominic. If you liked this episode, consider liking or subscribing to the podcast, or better yet, share the episode with a friend. It helps us find listeners like you. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. Thank you so much for listening.
My name is Liz, and as a teacher, I think that WBEZ provides endless sources that I can bring back to my students where they can also engage in a deeper understanding. I teach government, I teach U.S. history, and I have used sources from WBEZ in order to help enrich the understanding of my students.